If you go to their statements, if you go to the testimonies of so many Israeli leaders, so many Israeli historians, so many Israeli officials who have been in office, like whether they are generals in the army or they are in the intelligence with the Mossad and whatever, they all talk about this. And whether they are clerics, religious leaders, rabbis and whatever, there is a kind of a convergence, and many testimonies could be brought up very simply about their, if you want, a prophecy about the demise of Israel. They all talk about the 80 years. It hasn't, no Israeli, no Jewish state has long or has survived more than 80 years, and now they are itching very closely to the 80 years. I mean, more importantly, when you see on the other side, when you see the Lebanese, when you see the Syrians, when you see the Palestinians, and basically, and most importantly, the Palestinians, who were the first victims of the Israeli occupation, of the world conspiracy, of Balfour Promise, of the British Empire, of the American Empire now, of the Western support. You're talking about people who are isolated, who are only supplied with arms from few and very few number of states. You're talking about Lebanon, you're talking about Syria, you're talking about Iran, and the whole world is behind the Israelis, supporting them and supplying them. If you go to the other side, I said, you asked about the Israeli side and what they say. Now come and see what's happening on the ground. The Palestinians, the Palestinian generations, the youngsters, they are fighting Israel as if Palestine was occupied just yesterday. Generation after generation, they hold this torch of liberation, of resistance against the Israelis. And this is very telling. This is very promising. We hold tightly into our cause with few supporters around, and they are, if you want, fed up with all of this world support to them and with this so-called state and entity that they hold to. They cannot continue. They are talking about their demise. They are talking about...
But Professor Moussaoui, I thought about this very hard, and I thought that reaching the promise of the hereafter, wa'adul akhira, as we know it, it needs a liberation project that puts the wheels of resistance action on the track of the train of the divine destiny, traveling towards the station of the promise of the hereafter without dependence that hinders action, or maybe recklessness that frustrates action. And it needs awareness with insight that makes that takes human action, not only just thoughts. The waiting hall on the sidewalk, the sideline of history, and protects it from jumping into the void of history like multiple liberation movements throughout the 20th and 21st century. How is Hezbollah preparing for this phase?
Actually, it's not Hezbollah who is preparing. When I was talking about the generation after generation, the most important thing is the will, the intention, the determination, is the resolve. And it's there. When it is there, there is a will. When there is a will, there is a way. And the will is there, and the way is there as well. The path is there. If you talk about the people of the world, now you know, and many people are aware that even inside the America, I mean, if you talk about the people, people are being brainwashed. People are being misled. They don't know about the reality. They only hear the mainstream media in America, which presents Israel as the oasis of democracy in the region. It was a desert and they turned it into a paradise. This is what they hear most of the time. But those who are aware of what's really happening, they know very well that their government is twisting the facts and is bringing fallacies into their minds and into their awareness. The awareness around the world, even there has been a statistic recently, a poll among the Democrats themselves who are now presiding, they say there is more inclination to the Palestinian right than what the Israelis have been doing. You're talking about 80 years of black, gray, whatever propaganda by the Israelis and the most important media outlets all over the world. It was not able to brainwash or to twist the will of the Palestinians. They are there, the generations are there, the faith, the deep conviction of liberation of Palestine is there. Hezbollah is one part, one group, a very leading, prominent, protagonist group against the Israelis. The Palestinians are there, the Arabs are there, and many of the free people in the world, they support the Palestinians. That's why I believe we are in the true path. Everything is prepared. We are only talking about a matter of time before before the liberation takes place. Yes, it has, and it needs preparation. Yes, it needs planning. Yes, it needs training. Yes, it needs arms. And here you see the Islamic Republic of Iran as the main stronghold for all of the liberation forces and groups and resistance forces and groups, in not only in Lebanon, but also in Palestine, in Syria, in Yemen, everywhere, in Iraq. Here you have a stronghold that is supporting, that is giving all the supplies. And more importantly, you have this wise leadership represented by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. You have this leadership and charismatic leadership of this Sayyid Nasrallah. You're talking about the allegiance of the people, their loyalty, their devotion to the cause. I believe those are the essence of any liberation, and those are the essence of any plan for the future of liberation.
Well, perfectly said, Dr. Mousaoui. Let us now move on to the second segment, where we'll be talking about how the confrontation with the Zionist entity will look like in the future.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Military echelons inside the Zionist Israeli entity do not hide their permanent intentions to launch a war against Lebanon, especially after the results they drew from the July 2006 war and the defeat they suffered in terms of not achieving the goals of the war after 33 days of fighting and being forced to accept a ceasefire without revealing the fate of its two soldiers, whose capture was the direct reason for the start of the aggression. How will the next confrontation look like in this following report?
Leaders of the Israeli entity have never hidden their permanent intentions to launch a war against the Republic of Lebanon, especially after the results they viewed of what they called the Second Lebanon War, known to us in the region as the July 2006 War. Zionists suffered a resounding defeat in 2006 in terms of not achieving the goals of the war after 33 days of fighting and then being forced to accept a ceasefire without ever revealing the fate of its two soldiers, who once were captured, the aggression began. On August 14, 2006, the war ended. Ehud Olmert stood in the Knesset to announce what he considered a victory. But the disapproving voices emanated from the members of the Knesset extended outside it, forcing occupation government to form the Vinograd Committee to investigate the readiness and performance of officials in the government and the security establishment in the war. The committee concluded months later that the war was a fiasco on the part of Olmert and his officials. Since that time, the military establishment has been preparing for the scenario of the next war with Hezbollah, evaluating the annual exercises and maneuvers and issuing reports that it acknowledges that it serves a main goal, which is, quote, the war in the north, unquote, and the scenario of confronting the elements of the resistance. The Israeli entity did not launch a war for 17 years. Its drums were beaten more than once, and it came close to erupting on many occasions. However, the reactions of the Lebanese resistance and its loud rhetoric were the cause of the Israeli entity's permanent retreat, on the basis that the preparation for war prevents its occurrence. The two sides, however, consider the war is inevitably coming, and what supports this is the statements of the two parties and their high readiness for it. On the anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon this year, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, "Whoever assumes that the battle with the occupation has ended is delusional." He warned the Israeli occupation leaders who keep bringing up the Great War that this war will include all borders and its fields will be packed with hundreds of thousands of fighters. This was repeated more than once by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Hezbollah officials, albeit in different forms. The party's latest maneuver on May 21, 2023, the resistance's latest maneuver on May 21, 2023, indicated that it is focusing on offensive capabilities and training in preparation for the next war. The Israeli occupation, for their part, do not stop talking about preparing for a war against Hezbollah and warn that the army and the home front are not ready to wage this war, especially if it expands to include the rest of the resistance axis.
We are back from Beirut with Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thanks again for being with us, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, in the first week of July, we all read what the Israeli military intelligence Amman said. It expected an all-out confrontation to break out on the northern front, that's the border between Lebanon and occupied Palestine, attributing the matter to the, quote, erosion of the home deterrence in the face of Hezbollah. How do you see this next confrontation?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's difficult to fathom the next scenario, what's going to happen, actually. But it's basically clear for us is that we have the upper hand and we are in a better position 10 times, 100 times than we were at any time in the past. More importantly, if you go back to the reports and to the testimonies against of the Israelis, whenever an operation used to take place, the victorious, the glorious operations of the resistance, the Israelis used to say that Hezbollah is one step ahead of us. I can tell you now, I mean, out of information that are spreading everywhere, and it's becoming a common fact, that Hezbollah is 10 steps ahead of the Israelis. Had the Israelis been able to start a war before, every time the Israelis want to start a war, or they, if you want, threaten that they are going to bring Lebanon back to the Stone Age or whatever, a new revealing of the capabilities of the resistance come and put the Israelis on their knees, actually, before any confrontation takes place. What I can tell you, we have the upper hand. The resistance in Lebanon has the initiative now. The Israelis are not in a position to be able to handle the brunt of any confrontation in the future. Hezbollah is being elevated into a kind of existential threat to the existence of Israel itself. And we're talking about one resistance group. So how come if you talk about a sector, a whole axis of resistance, when you talk about the Islamic resistance, about Hezbollah resistance that is being designated as an existential threat to Israel, to all of the entity of Israel, and its capability to spread out its rockets all over the Palestinian territories and all of the Israeli points and military options.
I had the pleasure and the opportunity, actually, to visit last Saturday parts of the Lebanese territories that witnessed heightened clashes between the Israeli entity and our glorious Hezbollah fighters.
I read what you put in the social media.
It's the least that I could do, but we met with leaders of the resistance and as well. Now, I'm not going to talk emotionally what that did to me, but we spoke about the capabilities and the developments of the resistance, the way you just explained, and the development of the resistance, the increase in its numbers, its equipment, and the experience of its fighters contributed very much to the postponing of the occurrence of the war and increased the Israeli fear of the consequences of this war. But in short, Israel now finds itself between a rock and a hard place, because it's two bitter choices, as the war today will cost it more than it can bear, and the continuation of the idea of just postponing the war makes its image ever so eroding. Exactly. Which of these options do you think the occupation will take?
Well, I'm sure, I don't know what to say. No, sure is not the point. I am confident that the Israelis are not in a position to start a war now. They are only trying as much as they can to elevate their image in the eyes of their people. And if you all recall this report by the Israelis, they themselves said that all the Israelis in the northern settlements and in the northern border of Palestine adjacent to the Lebanese borders are not in a position to be defended, and they have to depend on themselves, because they expect that the Hezbollah fighters would storm the northern part, the Galilee and whatever, and they can do nothing about it. So here it has always been that the Israelis can come to Lebanon. It's a kind of picnic, and they would come in the morning because they can finish Lebanon in 2, 3, 4 hours. Now the thing has switched and has been twisted dramatically. They are afraid that the Lebanese resistance, the Islamic resistance, Hezbollah fighters are going to storm and go there. And that's why they are building these fences and all of these walls around.
They don't know that we can fly if we want to.
So,
but there's this thing that they still have the upper hand in, which is the aerial force, the air force
true,
that they
true.
Have. But
to a certain extent.
Exactly.
Because
My question is, who said that the resistance would allow the occupation freedom of aerial movements
their hands are not free.
The way it was in 2006?
Their hands are not free as they used to be. This is one thing. And you remember, and we all remember, that the resistance, you did say something about your visit, about the capabilities, about the experience, about the armaments, whatever. But we all know that Hezbollah and the resistance has always been keeping, and they continue to keep surprises, military surprises or technicalities or kind of weapons that nobody would have imagined, as what happened in 2006 with the Sa'ar, with the warship that has been targeted by the rockets of Hezbollah, the air-to-water or land-to-water missiles that has been used. So nobody could predict what kind of armaments would appear in any future confrontation. This is for sure. And the other thing is that the Israelis are not prepared psychologically to take it anymore. That's why they only would make threats and would make warnings. And this is not going to find any reality, in fact, actually.
That's we spoke about that a lot, and we also spoke about the weaponry that Israel does not really know what the Islamic Resistance has, especially the drones part, because we are now all attached to our screens, to our smartphones, watching what's happening in Ukraine between the Russian Federation and the NATO and U.S. forces in Ukraine, and how Russia is fighting with drones. This is, I mean, we're witnessing a new kind of war, and we asked about that, and the resistance was reluctant to tell us because they want to keep it a secret and a surprise for the Israeli entity. But bringing us here, just hanging on to everything that has happened and being proud of that victory, what do you tell the people of the world listening and watching us about this very moment in time when Israel is at its weakest?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's a theme that should be construed, should be understood, and should be held tight to our hearts and souls and spirits. What's really meaningful in this life is to have a meaning of life. I go back to the first thing that I mentioned. Life without without independence, life without freedom, life without dignity is not a life. Death is better than to die is better than to live under humiliation and without dignity and independence.
Indeed.
That's why
Minna Dilla is
exactly,
that.
Exactly. That's why what I can simply say is that the Lebanese resistance has given a pattern, has given a symbol, has given a pattern to be emulated by all parties, by all people around the world, by all resistance forces against the occupation and against any enemy. When there is a will, there is a way. They say not only the Islamic resistance, the Palestinians. Now see what's happening in Jenin, see what's happening in the West Bank. We saw what happened in Gaza that was liberated. South Lebanon was liberated. See what's happening in Yemen, see what's happening in Afghanistan, see what's happening in Iraq. So see what's happening in Syria. So we're talking about things that have been, if you want, tested on ground, and it gives and it paid this kind of independence and dignity. So we can simply say this is a day to be celebrated by all free people of the world, all those who are under occupation, all those who are under hegemony, the American, the Israeli hegemony, the Western hegemony. They should know that there is always a way to resist against any kind of occupation, no matter how ruthless it is, no matter how savage it is. We could simply be able to do a lot in order to fight it back, in order to regain our dignity, regain our land, regain our freedom and independence.
Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, a mentor, an idol, and a dear friend, Lebanese member of the parliament and the loyalty to the resistance bloc, Hezbollah, thank you immensely for being with us and contributing
Pleasure.
To our show despite your schedule, your packed schedule. Thank you for being here. Ladies and gents, thank you. Do celebrate with us August 14, because it is a memory to celebrate against the Israeli entity. See you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. In the U.S., six white police officers have agreed to sentences of between 5 and 30 years, recommended by Mississippi prosecutors. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. Six former Mississippi law enforcement officers, all of whom are white, have pleaded guilty to state charges for torturing two black men in a racist assault in the United States. All six had also recently admitted their guilt in a connected federal civil rights case. They appeared in a Rankin County courtroom in Brandon, Mississippi, on Monday, 14th of August. The men include five former Rankin County Sheriff's deputies, Brett McAlpin, Hunter Elwood, Christian Dedman, Jeffrey Middleton, and Daniel Updike, and a former police officer from the city of Richland, Mississippi, Joshua Hartfield. Some of them nicknamed themselves the Goon Squad. In their crimes, federal prosecutors saw echoes of the racist violence committed against civil rights activists in 1964. Locally, Sheriff Brian Bailey called it the worst case of police brutality he had ever seen. In January, the officers entered a house without a search warrant and handcuffed and assaulted the two men with stun guns and various other objects. The officers mocked the two men with racial slurs in a 90-minute torture session, then devised a cover-up that included planting drugs and a gun, leading to false charges that stood against the victims for months. Their conspiracy unraveled after one of the police officers told the sheriff he had lied, leading to confessions from the others. The charges against the victims were not dropped until June, after federal and state investigators got involved, according to their lawyer. All six law enforcement officers agreed to sentences recommended by state prosecutors ranging from 5 to 30 years, although the judge is not bound by these suggestions. Time served for the state convictions will run concurrently with the potentially longer federal sentences they may receive in November. The victims, Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker, arrived together to Monday's hearing and sat in the front row, just feet from their attackers' families. They were embraced by Monica Lee, the mother of Damian Cameron, a black man who died in Elwood's custody in 2021. I enjoyed the view of seeking the walk of shame, head down, the disgust everybody felt for them and that they feel for themselves, Parker said after the officers were led away in shackles. I hope this is a lesson to everybody out there. Justice will be served. The charges followed an Associated Press investigation in March that linked some of the police officers to at least four violent encounters since 2019, which left two black men dead. All six of the former officers pleaded guilty to state charges of obstruction of justice and conspiracy to hinder prosecution. Hunter Elwood and Christian Deadman, who kicked in a door, also admitted to home invasion. Hunter Elwood pleaded guilty to aggravated assault for shoving a gun into Jenkins's mouth and pulling the trigger, releasing a bullet that lacerated his tongue, shattered his jaw, and exited through his neck. Authorities described the incident as a mock execution which had gone awry. After details of the case became public, some residents pointed to a police culture they said gives officers carte blanche to abuse their power. The two African Americans, Jenkins and Parker, were targeted because a white neighbor complained that the two black men were staying at home with a white woman. Parker was a childhood friend of the homeowner, Chrissy Wally, who was at the hospital at the time. She has been paralyzed since she was 15 years old, and Parker was helping take care of her. "He's a blessing. Every time I've needed him, he's been there," Wally said in a February interview. "There were times I've been living here by myself and I didn't know what I was going to do." Jenkins still had difficulty speaking because of his injuries. He can only eat soft food easily and has recurrent nightmares. "As far as justice, I knew we were going to get it," Jenkins said, "but I thought it was maybe going to take longer." Other consequences remain to be determined. Hunter Elwood and other deputies continue to face other probes and allegations of abuse of power. Bailey, the Rankin County Sheriff, applauded the investigation that led to the guilty pleas. "I believe today's guilty pleas show the community that our system of checks and balances is effective," Bailey said in a statement. Court documents unsealed by federal prosecutors suggest only some members of the Goon Squad participated in the illegal raid. There are other Rankin County deputies known to the United States Attorney, the document says. "We would certainly hope that they continue to investigate the Goon Squad and other outstanding claims that may exist against these police officers as well as other officers," according to Trent Walker, a lawyer for the two African Americans, Jenkins and Parker. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Six white former Mississippi law enforcement officers pleaded guilty to state charges on Monday, 14th of August, for torturing two black men in a racist assault that ended with a deputy shooting one victim in the mouth in what authorities called a mock execution. All six had recently admitted their guilt in a connected federal civil rights case. Prosecutors say some of the police officers nicknamed themselves the Goon Squad because of their willingness to use excessive force and cover it up. In January, the officers entered a house without a search warrant and handcuffed and assaulted the two black men with stun guns and various other objects. The officers mocked them with racial slurs through a 90-minute torture session, then devised a cover-up that included planting drugs and a gun, leading to false charges that could have sent the victims to prison for many years. Their conspiracy unraveled months later after one of the officers told the sheriff he had lied, leading to confessions from the others. Each one agreed to sentences recommended by state prosecutors ranging from 5 to 30 years, although the judge isn't bound by that. Time served for the state charges will run concurrently with federal sentences they're scheduled to receive. Each could get longer prison sentences in federal court next November. The men include five former Rankin County Sheriff deputies, Brett McAlpin, Hunter Elwood, Christian Deadman, Jeffrey Middleton, and Daniel Updike, and a police officer from the city of Richland, Mississippi, Joshua Hartfield. All six pleaded guilty to state charges of obstruction of justice and conspiracy to hinder prosecution. Christian Deadman and Hunter Elwood who kicked in a door, pleaded guilty to additional charges of home invasion. Hunter Elwood also pleaded guilty to aggravated assault for shoving a gun into the mouth of one of the victims and pulling the trigger, in what authorities called a mock execution. The victims, Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker, arrived together. They sat in the front row, just a few feet away from the attackers' families. Monica Lee, the mother of Damian Cameron, another black man who died in 2021 after Hunter Elwood punched and tased him during an arrest, embraced both men. After the brazen acts of police violence in Rankin County came to light, some residents pointed to a police culture they said gave police officers carte blanche to abuse their power. The civil rights charges followed an Associated Press investigation linking some of the officers to at least four violent encounters with black men since 2019, which left two African Americans dead and another with lasting injuries. The Justice Department launched a civil rights probe back in February.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
America currently spends more on defense than the next 10 countries combined. Nearly 45% of global defense spending belongs to America. But when you look at Uncle Sam's wars in the past decades, namely in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria, many of them have turned into disasters. The question is, why has the country so little to show for the blood and treasure it's invested in its wars? Why can't America win its wars? The woes of the American military. A closer look at the fabric of America's military institution will reveal the answer. The institution has been infested with chronic problems like rising neo-Nazism and far-right ideology, rampant rape cases, and recruiting crises. A rather shocking report shows that a former U.S. soldier got 45 years in prison for helping a neo-Nazi group plot to kill troops. Other reports show that neo-Nazi Satanism and far-right ideologies have increased in the U.S. military. The far-right extremism has also been on the rise in the general public. Now the question is this just a reflection of the general tendency or the case in the military institution could be worse?
It's a complex question. Satanism is very different from neo-Nazism. It has been reported on and speculated and rumored that many of the United States elite, very wealthy people, including politicians, are Satanists. They have reportedly made trips to Jeffrey Epstein's island off the Atlantic coast, where satanic rituals take place. There hasn't been any real proof of this as of now. In terms of neo-Nazism, there are over 500 designated groups by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. These are radical far right-wing people, and they are all heavily armed. In terms of the army, I haven't heard about any neo-Nazi groups in the army, but there are certainly many in the army who are very conservative and could be considered as far-right extremists. They are all heavily armed, and many of these groups distrust the government, and they have for many decades, and many are preparing for armed conflict against the government.
A report by the Southern Poverty Law Center shows one in five applicants to the white supremacist group Patriot Front claim to hold current or former ties to the U.S. military. Patriot Front is a white supremacist and neo-fascist hate group that emerged as a rebrand of the neo-Nazi organization after the so-called Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Why are these people getting so radicalized?
I don't really necessarily look at it as the far right, right? You know, I understand how people can get into these kind of little quagmires and they can play this game of far right and far left. I think these people that they do radicalize and push over the edge are people who are coming from some bad situations. And I think that's what we need to look at is the actual root of what's going on. It's very easy to move these people in a certain direction. And when I say these people and who's moving them, I'm talking about all these deep state intelligence apparatus like the FBI. They have to justify their budget. So if they can prove that there's radicals on either side of the fence and make sure that we put them in a quagmire of sorts of red team versus blue team and keep people divided, then they'll do so. But I've always said this before, and I'll say it again. It's because of the conditions these gentlemen are coming out of. All forms of existing bigotry are hyperinflated out of times of economic distress. So these people are they're suffering, they're lost. The home in America has been broken down. So it's very easy to radicalize these people.
In March 2021, the Pentagon released a report that cited domestic extremist groups posing an increasing threat to the military by attempting to recruit service members and in certain situations, join the military to gain combat experience. What are the reasons for the shift towards far-right extremism in both public and military cases?
As I mentioned above, I think primarily it's a lack of trust in the government. Many people are realizing that the government has lied to them and the government does not represent their interest. And this is the same in the military command structure. You don't get to the top of the command by being controversial. These generals and higher officers get there because they do the bidding of the politicians and the people in the White House. And I believe this is the source of this shift to the right, and in many cases, far-right extremism.
The extremism has not just shifted to the right. There are now many people who say the far-left ideology is just as bad. In both instances, reasons can be given to tip the scale in one direction or the other. And now the $64,000 question is, why are these extremists ending up serving in the army?
Well, I think it's just society as a whole. And once again, I don't think it's a shift to the far right or far left. They're doing it on both sides of the fence. We're getting pushed here from the puppet masters behind the scene. And that is mainly because they want to keep people divided and keep people scared. And they also want to justify their existence. You know, when you look at a lot of these articles, they'll always mention the FBI, but they'll mention them late and they'll push forth all the things that the neighbors need to blame each other, the point the fingers at each other. And also, too, as well, when you get these people in the state, you can get them and you can weaponize them and use them in your foreign policy, especially if you have them in the military. We know for many years that the United States military has always, and the intelligence agencies, has always funded the most radical groups. It's said that in the Ukraine, for instance, that we knew, and that is the CIA and the American Empire, we knew that the Ukrainian military wouldn't fire on their own people in the Donbass. So what did we do? We found the most craziest radical group in the Azov Battalion because we knew they would do the deed. So it's being able to get using people as a weapon, but as the ultimate weapon. And so when you get the most radicalized of people, you can get them to do basically anything, Ali.
The Pentagon has also reported that the U.S. military experienced its highest recorded level of sexual assault among women. The report shows that reports of sexual assault increased by roughly 13% in 2021 compared with the previous year. A staggering 8.4% of active duty women are estimated to have experienced some form of unwanted sexual contact.
It's fairly well known if one travels to outside of the country to any of the 800 United States military bases in more than 90 countries, that around every single base there are incidents of rape, murder, and other violent crimes, including robbery and burglary. This is not something new. This has been going on for decades and decades. And what has the military done? I think basically nothing to curb this problem. They cover it up. They don't allow the people who have committed these atrocities to go on trial in those countries where they are serving. And they either stay there or they return to the United States. So it's a very, very huge problem within the military, but it's a huge problem with the respect that the United States is losing and has lost in these countries where these 800 bases basically are occupying forces.
Such sexual assaults in the military have been reported for many years. The staggering numbers have forced lawmakers to pass laws that will prosecute cases of rape and sexual assault out of the hands of the military commanders. Still, the Pentagon report says that only 39% of women in the military said they trusted the system to treat them with dignity and respect after such an incident.
I do agree that it's somewhat damaging, but I don't think it really bothers the heads at the top. Once again, this is a problem with society. We have a broken society. Our young men and women are drugged up. They're thrust upon with all these different substances. Their house is broken. And at the end of the day, I know that the military, since it's an all-voluntarily military, that they just want to make sure that they're going to get some killers. So they're going to have to take on some of the worst, and they're just going to weed out the bad ones. And when I say bad for them, those are the ones who can't pick up a gun and go kill somebody for them, who cause too much problems within their own groups in the military. But they'll just weed them out and get the ones that will do the jobs for them.
Sexual assault erodes the trust and cohesion in the military. The data shows 6 out of 10 women in the Army did not express trust in the military to ensure their safety after an incident. In general, do you think the hierarchy or the top brass in the U.S. military really cares about such damaging reports?
No. At the end of the day, the top brass of the military do not care that there are these damaging reports, because you know why? It's never going to reflect on themselves. It's never going to reflect on the military. It's only going to reflect on the individual. And they have ways of putting it on the individual and stepping out and giving themselves no accountability whatsoever. That's what they've been doing for quite some time. What do they want? They want soldiers who can kill, right? And it is a voluntary military. So therefore, they do have to weed out these people. But at the end of the day, all they really do care about is if they can get that person to go and do what's necessary for them. And they've glorified every single step of the way the killing in which needs to be done by demonizing the enemy. The people from Iran are the enemy. The people from Russia are the enemy. The people from China are the enemy. Our society doesn't travel enough to these countries or open up our cultures. All we are is taught in school to hate somebody that we don't know and that we've never met. So I don't think the top brass of the military does care. They have all these mechanisms within their treasure chest in which they can manipulate their soldiers to go and kill in the name of U.S. empire.
Senior officers in the U.S. military, active and retired, frequently appear in the media for legal or ethical offenses, ranging from taking bribes to using their official title in the service of partisan politics. The reputation of the armed forces is being put at risk by the bad behavior of numerous senior officers in matters political, occupational, and financial.
Now, in terms of the high command, as I mentioned before, you don't get to the top without doing the bidding of the President of the United States and the foreign policy elites. You just don't get there. So basically, they are yes men and yes women. And it does seem that they don't really care. They're concerned more with preserving the reputation and sugarcoating things or sweeping them under the carpet.
Reports also show that the U.S. Army, over the past year, again increased the number of its recruits who have prior criminal records by granting them special exceptions. So why recruit criminals?
We have an all-volunteer military, and that's going to cause some problems because, quite frankly, I think the military and the United States foreign policy has caught up to the people, and they're starting to realize that, hey, man, I've been told to go hate this guy who looks different than me. I've been told to go hate this country that is not like me, that this country, they're causing the problems. Well, I think that's caught up to the people, and they realize, hey, maybe it's not the immigrant that they're saying or the foreigner that they're saying is the problem. Maybe it's the military itself. And when that happens, you're going to have less people joining, less people being recruited that they can get involved. So what do you have to do? You have to go to people who have no choices. And a lot of times, that's people who are going to jail. They did this during the Ronald Reagan era, where Ronald Reagan sent so many people, he told them, you can go to jail for 6 years or you can go to the military for 4 years. Make a choice. And they took the choice of joining the military. So now you're not going to get the best of the best. You're going to get people who have no choices, who are looking for a way out. So they're going to just jump on in and go fight in the military. And that's where they're at right now, because they are losing legitimate recruiting tools because their foreign policy is so screwed up.
The military routinely grants waivers to recruits with past criminal behavior, medical problems, or low aptitude scores that would otherwise disqualify them from service. The Army has been struggling to increase the size of its force amid its increasingly unpopular campaigns in West Asia.
First off, the military and all of the branches are desperate to fulfill their recruiting quotas. And this has been the case for several years. They're desperate to not be able to replace the troops as they once were. There's several reasons for this, but what they're doing is changing the requirements for minor criminal offenses, marijuana smoking, for example. They've changed the requirements. I mentioned just previously about gays, transgenders, obese people, and people without at least a high school degree. These were all very, very strict requirements in previous years, and now they've been laxed. They've been reduced. This has had a detrimental effect on the troops.
The Army missed its recruitment goal for fiscal 2022 by 25%, or 15,000 soldiers. In July, it also cut its projection for the overall size of its force for this fiscal year by 10,000 and projected that it will likely see another decline in 2023. The Secretary of the U.S. Army says the nation risks falling behind in the race against China if it cannot recruit enough Americans into the service to be trained on how national defense is being remade for future conflicts.
I mean, they're still trying to do everything they can to get people to go, right? So I think the methods and the tactics have changed. They still have the same goal, to get as many people in as there's possible that will fight in the military at their command and do what they have to do. But we have a different society here at home. We have different tools. We have technology that is boom. So what do you do now? How do you recruit people? Well, you use your propaganda. How about your video games? I mean, there are video games out there. I believe it's, I can't even remember one of the games, but it's a military war game where they have white helmets as the good guys coming on in. So they try to tell these stories as you're addicted to a video game, and they try to put out a narrative in which it's going to attract to you and say, okay, this is doing my duty. This is patriotic here if I join the military. Even the methods in which they use the video game controllers are the way they now – some they're similar to the way drones are flown. So they've changed the methods in which they try to recruit people. But at the end of the day, how much is it going to work? When your foreign policy is that bad, when everybody is starving here at home, when you have the homeless count almost over 750,000 in the United States, sooner or later, people are going to start saying, wait a second, it's not that guy. It's this guy who's lying to me. And that's why they have problems here in the United States. People know they're lying.
Many experts believe the reason why the United States failed in its military campaign in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq was because of the military itself. For instance, renowned political scientist John Mearsheimer, who also served for more than 10 years in the U.S. military, says one of the reasons for the failures of U.S. wars in the Middle East was the fabric of the U.S. military institution itself. He says it is impossible to drive nation building with the U.S. military.
I completely agree with John Mearsheimer. It goes all the way back to the war in Vietnam, where the United States said we're trying to build a nation of freedom and democracy. It's never been that way. It's never been that way in any of the adventures, military adventures, that the United States has undertaken since Vietnam. That was never the case in Iraq. It was never the case in Syria. It was never the case in Libya. And it was never the case in Afghanistan, in Yemen, Somalia, and so many other places. It's never been about nation building. It's about the imposition of American rule and domination. And it's about America's national security interest. And what that means is money, resources, and cheap labor. This is at the root of America's wars abroad.
The U.S. military flounders in the human domain of conflict with respect to foes, friends, and bystanders alike. Failure to engage with the building blocks of humanity, culture, society, politics, economics, and religion leaves its strategies and plans as mere schemes, leading to maim and murder in different places in the world. The Afghan collapse provided a final exclamation point in that regard. Nation building is the last thing that the U.S. military could do.
My take on that is he's 100% right. You know what I'm saying? There's too much ignorance involved when it comes to the foreign policy aspect of Americans. We don't get out there. We don't understand other cultures. We don't listen. We don't learn. And we get duped by this whole pipe dream of sorts that, you know, we're spreading democracy and we're providing, you know, freedom all over the world. And those are used to be some great names, great words, freedom and democracy. But it's not up to us to decide what happens on the other side of the world. And unfortunately, I think people have found out that it's not about us spreading democracy or spreading freedom. It's about our corporations taking resources and extracting them from these countries.
A new great game is underway. The United States' unipolar moment is coming to a close. As a hegemon on borrowed time, Uncle Sam must compete to secure his interests. But there is a big problem. His military is just not up to the task.
The American military is one of the biggest militaries in the world, and it is also the most destructive force in the world. America's military has no moral, political, or historical right to even exist, as America itself is an illegal settler colony. This makes the U.S. military's existence a crime against humanity, and all the wars it's waged from Vietnam to Iraq to Libya to Afghanistan have all been crimes against the human race. But how did the American military get to how it is? And how is the military still maintained? To start, The American military, it was founded on June 14th, 1775. The slaveholding George Washington, he was the first commander of the Continental Army. The first war was the so-called American Revolution, which was America's attempt to break free from the British Empire and have a complete monopoly over American capitalism and thus slavery. From that day on, the military was founded to protect the interests of the settler colony of America and thus expand the so-called American Empire. In April of 1846, the U.S. military fought the Mexican-American War, in which the USA was seeking to steal Texas out of the hands of the control of Mexico. And this is what the American military is about. It's about land theft. The U.S. military has also been used historically to steal land from indigenous people and to enact genocide against indigenous peoples. This shows us how the foundation of the U.S. military is about protecting the capitalist interests of the settler colony, as well as advancing them through theft of land, and thus the resources that the land holds. And if we know anything about history, the formation of the military was about the exploitation and enslavement and genocide of African people. And to this very day, the U.S. military is deeply connected to the prison industrial complex. And the prison industrial complex is just the evolution of chattel slavery, which America was founded on. America built its entire economy off of slavery, which then allowed for major investments into America's so-called armed forces. The same type of relationship still exists today, as prison labor, aka slave labor, is used to outfit and arm the U.S. military. It's been reported that those incarcerated are forced to make jackets, uniforms, helmets, shoes, and even flak vests for the U.S. military, as well as body armor. Not only that, but inmates are also building parts for Patriot missile systems, as well as other weapons of mass, as little as 23 cents. 23 cents. This again shows exploit black people in America, the enslavement of black people in America, the expansion of the U.S. How sick is this? That literally the enslavement of black people here in America is at the foundation of the U.S. Empire's expansion, which then leads the empire to bomb black and brown people all across the world. And ultimately, if we believe in humanity, we must stop. We must stop American imperialism and its crimes against humanity. We all have the right. We all have the right to be free from American imperialism. This is Power to the People.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, the Federation of Trade Unions says British workers have suffered a double whammy of high inflation and historically poor wage growth. The Federation of Trade Unions says ministers must stop scapegoating workers and come up with a credible plan to lift living standards and boost economic growth. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. The UK fiscal watchdog warned that Britain's public finances are in a very risky period after a series of shocks left it in a vulnerable position to tackle an ageing population. The Office for Budget Responsibility, the OBR, suggested that unsustainable debt levels meant the government was facing further tax rises or significant cuts to spending. The watchdog, the Office for Budget Responsibility, said Britain's state finances have been badly shaken by a triple shock from the COVID pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and the cost of living crisis, causing public debt to balloon. The government's debt pile grew to more than 100% of